taken all the patches off of your flight suit so that if you got shot down and became a POW, there would be no markings as to who you were. I've spent now almost 20 years learning to drop bombs, fight air to air, shoot the gun. Here we are going to fight tomorrow. I thought I'd never see the day that any of that 20 years of training would come to fruition. And here it was. We're on the doorstep.
Welcome back, you guys, to the Aviator's Guide, a place for pilot learning. I'm your host, Holly Bellino, as usual, and today I'm beyond pleased and honored to have my guest on today, Rear Admiral Jib Godwin. Sir, thank you so much for being with me today. I really appreciate your time and being here on my show.
Holly, glad to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Just happy to have you on here to learn something from you. I actually became acquainted with Jib through a wonderful soul at the WAI conference in March of this last year, and she was kind enough to coordinate this today so that he could be on the show. So hopefully we will learn a thing or two from him because he is incredibly experienced. Let me give you a little background on him and try to keep up because this truly American man's resume is longer than a holding pattern at LAX. Rear Admiral Godwin is the president and CEO of Mercy Medical Angels, a nonprofit that provides free air transportation for patients in need of medical care. That's amazing. He has worlds of experience in naval aviation and an incredible track record in both military and civilian airspace leadership. He has a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering from Tulane University, where he also played football. He is also the president and owner of Brightworks, Inc., which is a company that provides consulting services in aerospace, IT, and cyber. He was also the managing director of PricewaterhouseCoopers Public Sector, vice president of Northrop Grumman Information Systems, vice president of Dynamic Analytics and Testing, and vice president of Athena Technologies, Inc. Wow. He's a veteran with over 33 years of service in the United States Navy, with more than 2,000 hours in the A7 Corsair, and over 2,000 hours in the F-18 Hornet. Admiral Godwin flew 34 missions during Operation Desert Storm in 1991, and he is a born and raised Texan. And yes, that man knows how to fly and groom the perfect mustache. I mean, come on, if that mustache had wings, it'd be clear for takeoff.
Funny story about the mustache. This would probably jump into the middle of, my career. I was CEO of VFA-192 in Japan, and this is post-Desert Storm, and I was being asked to come interview for the Blue Angels CEO job, but we had three kids at the time, and the youngest one was about two and a half years old, and she had never seen me without a mustache, and so now I'm in the bathroom because to interview to the Blue Angel job, you had to be clean shaven. On this side of my face, the bathroom door is over to my left. I shaved off the white side of my mustache, left the left one there. And so when I turned around and looked at my daughter, who was standing there watching me shave, she went screaming down the hall because it was scaring her.
I bet it did.
Right. So that is the only time since I've been in college that I've not had a mustache. Was that?
Wow.
That two-day period. So
I've seen a lot of photos of you with that mustache. Very nice mustache. Before we dive into the Mercy Medical Angels, I'd love to get to know you a little bit better. Starting with your naval aviation background, as I'm sure my followers and listeners are just as curious as I am. So you were commissioned in the U.S. Navy after graduating from Tulane, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what was Navy pilot training like back in the 70s?
A lot different than it is now. We were flying the T-2 Buckeye and the A-4 Skyhawks. The primary jet trainers were rudimentary and gave you the basic instruments, just navigating and stuff like that, but really didn't have the tactical sort of stuff. So when you graduated from the T-2 basic jet to the advanced jet, which is the A-4. The A-4 had combat experience, and so it gave you a little bit more of what a tactical airplane was all about. Now, it's still, fairly rudimentary, but in the day, it was, state of the art, but it's a very great, stable platform. And so you learn all the tactical stuff from the training command before you ended up heading out to either Jacksonville, Florida, or Oceana, Virginia, or Miramar, which was a naval base at the time, not a Marine Corps base like it is today, or to Lemoore, California, which nobody liked because it's out in the middle of the desert.
You told me during your training, you were given JIB as your call sign. How did that come about?
We didn't really do call signs in the training command because most of the time you're flying with an instructor pilot in your airplane. If you go back in time, my mother did this to me. My father, my grandfather, and me all have the same name, same initials, except it's Junior, Senior, and the Third. So James Basil Godwin the Third wasn't going to suffice to my mother. And so my mother knew that my father liked turkey and dressing, and you always put giblet gravy on the dressing. And so she gave me the name Jib because she knew my dad would never forget that. My dad was a World War II Catalina pilot. He was one of those guys that shaped what I was thinking about doing in my career being a naval aviator. And his brother was also a naval aviator and was a Korean War guy that flew SPADs and FJ-1 series off of the carriers back in the day. He was later killed in a training accident between Pensacola and Meridian. And so those were the inspirations in my life for how I got to be a naval aviator. Now, I'll tell you, though, when my uncle was killed, my dad took it very hard and felt responsible for what happened to his brother. Later in my years, when my dad knew that I was going to go to Tulane, he said, "You're going to be in the ROTC program." So my father didn't want me to fly airplanes in the Navy. With that in mind, he was really adamant when I went to Tulane on my football scholarship that I joined the Reserve Officer Training course to be able to get my commission and press on. Being a good son, I disobeyed my father's orders, and I took pilot training as a young student in my junior year. They called it the Flight Indoctrination Program, and so I went out to the Lakefront Airport in New Orleans and got my private pilot's license before I went to Pensacola.
Was your dad very upset then that you went against his wishes?
No. As a matter of fact, after I did that, he was so supportive of what happened that later in life, when I take a look back, thought about three separate times that I was going to get out of the Navy. When I didn't do that and I made captain, my dad says, "Go over to Annapolis. I'm going to buy you a brand new uniform." And he bought me the new hat and everything. Both of those things are really expensive. So when I told my dad the choices that I'd made when I got my wings, he was really turned around in his thinking about what it meant being a naval aviator to him. Now, it was one of those things that he started to adopt the things that I was thinking about and the way that I was going in my career, you know, in the very early stages. Once I made my choice, he was all in. So it was really one of those things that I remember clearly, and especially with Memorial Day just having ended and my uncle having been killed, that always brings him back to my memory. These childhood experiences with both my father, you know, and his brother being naval aviators, doing the kibitzing, going back and forth with one another and challenging one another with all kinds of crazy things. And my uncle was a very flamboyant kind of guy. It was always fun to be around those two guys, laughing and joking and carrying on, and me intercepting all that in between. So that's how that all came about. It was just kind of natural, if you will.
So it was love at first flight.
Absolutely.
Do you still fly today? And what are you flying now? And does it feel weird to be going less than 500 knots?
When you started in a Cessna 150 and you flew it to 70 or 80 or 90 miles an hour, you're not going very fast then. You're learning the basic skills of what it takes to fly airplanes. But essentially, when I finished my career, my wife shook her finger at me and said, "You've had enough opportunities to challenge death that you don't need to fly your own airplane anymore." I can fly, and I've done a couple of things along the way, but generally speaking, I don't own an airplane. I would love to, but it's just one of those things. It's not in the cards right now. And I'm getting old enough where it's the love is still there, but the insurance and the medical and all this stuff really starts to take away from what you're able to do.
Absolutely. I could see that. Well, I'm sorry that you don't get to fly as much as you'd like to anymore, but at least you get to tag along with some Mercy Medical Angel flights. So that's really good.
Right.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Thinking back to your military time, what's one myth about military flying that Hollywood always gets wrong in the movies?
If you looked at the Top Gun Maverick movie, when they're flying the F-14s and they're flying air combat maneuvering, that is the last part of what really happens. There's a lot of things to get to the engagement before you really start to turn and burn. with another airplane. When they show the airplanes a couple of hundred feet apart, talking about guns and this, that, and the other, that's the unrealistic part of what goes on in Hollywood. And so it's great to see the most recent movie that came out, put them in a Super Hornet, and went more along the lines of what we really do to train and how we get into the situation. Then the fights that happened in that movie, outside of the CGI that was placed over Super Hornets to make that Russian airplane a Russian airplane. Well, it was really an F-18, but it just had a graphic over the top of it. The F-14 was also a graphic over the top of an F-18. So it made it more realistic, and the training and the thing that they were going through was much more realistic. But if you recall in the most recent movie, when the two youngsters are side by side with one another and Maverick says, "Bites on," and they come right up to him, you wouldn't do that. That's too close.
Okay, well, good to know. I feel like there's a lot of stuff like that when any pilot these days, when we go watch a movie, like the new movie, newish one, Carry On, or anything like that, we always find little things like, that's not how that works.
Right.
I feel like it's our pilot thing is to always find, it's just like anybody in the medical field watching something like Grey's Anatomy, they're like, that's not how it works. So it's just always funny to see your perspective for that kind of thing.
Right. Well, we got to preview that movie in Pensacola. We had all the aviation flag officers, active duty and retired, in the IMAX theater at the Naval Aviation Museum. And so a week before the movie came out, we got to highlight that. And so now all the wives were all in there with us. And so now there's a lot of hooting and hollering and a lot of stuff that's going on because there's a lot of love scenes and other things that took place in that movie. They go, okay, there you go. That's better. And the wives were all laughing at that. So it was really a fun time to see that movie with it, you know, after all the hype that had been around it for 3 or 4 years as well.
Man, that does sound like a really good time. I love that you got to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Thinking back to your military service as well, is there a moment from your service that people wouldn't expect happened? Maybe a funny story or a weird tradition?
If you go back to hails and farewells, they're a big deal when people are joining new outset or when they're leaving an outset. Maybe I'm too rigid in my career, my life, and structured with the things that I do. When they would bring me up at the hails and farewells, they would say, well, we'll just say goodbye to Jim because he didn't really do anything to distinguish himself in a negative way. So we got nothing to pick on. Years later, I was a department head in VFA 25. And a lot of guys ganged up on me at a hail and farewell and took ordnance tape and taped me to a chair. So they were trying to, you know, razz me about, you need to get out of your mindset that you've been in all these years. Now that didn't change me anyway. It was a funny to be part of that and really a good laugh and scratch kind of event that occurred.
Oh, man. Are you sure being taped down to a chair didn't change anything inside you?
No. Then,
if you could go back and relive any one moment from your aviation career, what moment would that be?
There's been so many things along the way that you can say. I'll tell a story about a decision that my wife and I made. I was a lieutenant commander. I was on the air wing staff. I was a landing signal officer. I was the air wing landing signal officer. We were having a hail and farewell. And at that party, the air wing commander knew that I was going to submit my resignation. So my wife and I had decided that we were going to go up to Oregon. We were going to take a recruiting job. And then we'd get out in Oregon and we'd live up there. That'd be it. And so we went to the party. It was at the boss's house. At some point, he grabbed my wife and walked out the back door through the garage to the backyard. And so I saw them leave, and he looked over his shoulder as he walked out the door. And so I didn't think anything about it. But you're just mingling, you know, and this and the other. I guess 30 minutes went by, and he came back in with a big smile on his face, and my wife came in behind him, and she had a beam stare at me. Something's going on here. So she walks up and gets about that far away from me and said, "You don't want to retire. You don't want to get out, do you?" And I go, "No, but we've made that decision. I'm good with the decision that we've made." And so she said, "You want to fly the F-18, don't you?" I was an A7 guy at the time. And I said, yeah, but I've made my decision and I've gotten to fly in the airplane one time because I helped them initiate the airplane in Lemoore, California. And so she looked at me square in the eye, says, nope, if we're going to do this, we're going to go all the way. We're going to do this right. You understand? Yes, ma'am. And so now you look back over time at that career decision. That was the second time that I thought about getting out. And so it was one of those inflection points in my career that changed everything. So that took me out of the A7 community. It put me into the F-18 community. Then the F-18 community helped my career go just a whole total different direction. If you look at Lemoore, you know, I laugh today. We just attended the Aviation Flag Officer Symposium down at Pensacola just a few weeks ago. I've listened to this for 3 years now where they are considering Lemoore, California as a hardship tour, and they're having trouble getting people to go to Lemoore. And I got to tell you, my wife and I spent 14 years in Lemoore. We had 3 children in Lemoore. It was one of those cities that in the day, in the 70s, mid-70s, you could drive downtown, park your car, leave the keys in the car, leave the car running and go into the bank and come back out and get in your car and drive away. There was no crime, no child abductions, no murder. It was a one flashing light town of about 4,000 people at the time and was about 7 or 8 miles away from the base. I look back on that and the church environments and the things that you did to interact with the community was just a totally different thing than it is today when people always have something to do and have got to go someplace or be somewhere. Kids are involved in all the things today that we didn't have our kids involved in because they really didn't have all that. There were no cell phones, no internet, all of that sort of stuff. So what do you do with the family? So the swimming pool in our backyard, the kids were in the pool from 9 o'clock in the morning until dinner time. They were always outside. They never came in the house, only to get something to eat. They always had their friends over. That was just a great place to be. And so I chuckle every time I hear the guys today, them paying bonuses for people to stay in or go to Lemoore to begin with. It's one of those things that marked a spot in my career because we left Lemoore in 1989 to go to Japan. My wife had a really hard time making that transition to being isolated in a foreign country. It was really a tough one because when I did the turnover with the CEO of the Golden Dragons at the time, before I left to go catch the ship into the Indian Ocean, John Pettit, his call sign was Grump, for the right reasons as well, said, I hope you can do better than I did because we were gone 75% of the time we were here in Japan and I failed. We were gone 83% of the time. So I left my wife and kids in Japan while I deployed. But from a perspective of what it did, the Midway and the Independence were the 2 carriers that I was on when I was over there. We always had flying money. We always deployed. We were always on the front end. We were at the tip of the spear all the time. With that in mind, as an aviator, to have those things where there's no downtime. You're always operational. You're always bombing someplace. You're going to practice or air-to-air combat with the Japanese forces up in the north end of the island, Honshu. I just thanked her so many times over for what she did. And that relationship between husband and wife in the military is really important. When my wife would say, well, I don't do anything important. I look at my kids today that range from 49 to 31 years old and go, I paid you a lot of money to educate those kids and to raise them up the right way. And so now it's great being able to pay her back to the things that we sacrificed, you know, in our career in the Navy, flying airplanes, off aircraft carriers.
It is very special, the relationship between military spouses. My husband's also in the military as well. He's an Army National Guard. I'm glad that you are able to pay her back for that in a sense.
What's funny, though, my daughter, probably 9 or 10 years old, I came off deployment, probably in the mid-80s time frame. There's a picture of her running out to meet me as we were getting out of the airplanes coming home off of a cruise. And she grabbed me and says, Dad, you've ruined my life because now I'm gone all the time. I didn't have the opportunity to do the things that other fathers have got the opportunity to do with their kids in sports or whatever happens to be. Now, fast forward, when she is dating a young man from the Naval Academy and she's getting ready to get married, I'm going, wait a second. What is this you told me years ago about me ruining your life and you're getting ready to marry yourself back into it? I don't want to hear. my wife and I got to live our life vicariously through those two, watching them from ensign, you know, to we retired him in July of last year as a captain in the Supply Corps out in San Diego. It's great to see those things, you know,
as it evolves,
right, over time.
That's so funny. Guess you didn't really ruin her life after all, then.
No. Yeah.
Well, so you said you went to Japan in 89. Is that right?
Yeah. 1989, 1992.
Okay. Wow. So then you came back for Desert Storm only a couple years later then, because you did 34 missions there. Can you tell us a little bit about one of those missions that you did? If it was just like, hey, this is why we train so hard, or what happened?
If I look back at my career at that time, it was 1990. We're waiting on the ship. We're the only carrier in the Persian Gulf at the time. They come out and tell us, you're getting ready to go into combat. We strike tomorrow morning, or, you know, late tonight. When you go back and reflect on, do you write letters home? I mean, my wife and I in the day wrote letters every day to one another. And now that took forever for those letters, 21 days, generally speaking, to get to each other, right? I go down and write a letter just before we start the flight, taking all the patches off of your flight suit, and you're neutering everything so that if you got shot down and became a POW, there would be no markings as to who you were. I flashed back and spent now almost 20 years learning to drop bombs, fight air to air, shoot the gun, fight as a twosome, as a foursome, as a section or a division. Here we are going to fight tomorrow. I thought I'd never see the day that any of that 20 years of training would come to fruition. And here it was. We're on the doorstep. I flew 4 straight days with 4 hours of sleep. At the end of that, there was a mission that they needed to fly. And they said, okay, it's time for you to kind of wind down. We started to bring the JOs into a flight and do the work that we did in those strike groups that we had going ashore. So I got to fly an air combat patrol for the carrier between Saudi Arabia and the ship. And I'm in orbit, and I've been up there for, I don't know, 4 hours or so, and I had the autopilot on, and it was in a turn, and I fell asleep for maybe 10 seconds or something like that, but it scared the daylights out of me, and so I was wired for the rest of the flight, because it's in the middle of the night, it's not a daytime, you know, and so now all of that no sleep was catching up to me at the end of this. But the worst part is yet to go, right? After you've got your adrenaline up and the rush of what you just experienced, now you got to come back and land on the ship at night as well. Probably one of those experiences that's not a direct shooting at somebody or dropping something on something. It was hairy in the early days because you've never been shot at before, never seen an air-to-air missile or an air-to-ground, you know, surface-to-air missile come up at you, never bombed a real target before. All those kinds of things that really come to realization, you know, all in one fell swoop. So if you take a look back since 1990 timeframe, there hadn't really been any combat other than a few little skirmishes with Iran in the Gulf or something like that before. When you fly a combat mission, you get to sign green ink in your logbook. If you're flying a daytime flight, it's a black ink. And if you're flying a nighttime flight, it's red ink. If it's a combination in black and red, then you took off in the day and landed at night. Or if it's red and black, then it's took off at night and flew in the day. That's changed a lot since then. But still, it's just one of those that getting green ink in the logbook, it was a big deal. The youngsters have been flying combat missions essentially from 1990 and current through today. They just bombed the Houthis just a couple of days ago. Super Hornets and Growlers and F-22s and JSF F-35s are all out there hurling bombs at the ground and at these targets. So it's pretty amazing for us to have that time between the end of the Vietnam War and Desert Storm to see that period of time of almost 20 years of nothing. And then we've been in constant combat since then. Everybody's got green ink in her logbook now.
Yes, it has definitely escalated quite a bit since then. You said you had to, of course, go land on the aircraft carrier at night. Do you know how many times you've had to land on an aircraft carrier?
914.
914.
Right. And wow. And about 35% of those are at night.
Ooh, that takes a lot of work, I bet. So in your eyes, what makes a great carrier pilot? Is it nerves, instinct, precision, or is it just the ability to land at night with fewer cuss words?
No. So compartmentalization as an aviator is really important. When you've got a critical thing to do like that, I'll tell you what, the blunt end of the ship has got pretty rough toll that it takes on you if you don't do it right. With that in mind, compartmentalizing on a night when there's bad weather, pitching deck, no horizon, and nothing but the ship for the lights and you and the airplane, and that's it. You have to compartmentalize that, because if you don't, then you get into a vicious cycle of not being able to get aboard the ship and being on the tanker, a whole bunch of others. You could put your training to work, because you do a lot of practicing in the carrier landing pattern around the airfield. The washout rate for people that didn't make it through carrier calls was 65%. I made it on my first time at the ship. And so I was, you know, in the 35 category, right? That was unique in the day. Now landing on the carrier is much simpler. It's simplified a whole bunch of things in training. So now the airplane has essentially got you on glide slope, on center line, and on angle attack.
Definitely, you would say easier than it used to be back when you did it.
Yeah, it's, you know, the granny board was where you got graded by the LSO on a good pass, a medium grade pass, or an excellent pass, or a really crappy pass. But the big deal is, it's not about landing grades. It's about making the recovery happen on time and getting it over and done with, and it being safe and not losing an airplane because you hit the back of the ship, or you bolted, or you flew into the water off the angle deck. Really a, you know, a whole different ballgame today than it was when it was more manual stuff. You know, if you go back to Vietnam as an example, you know, by the way, I'm a Vietnam veteran as well. I wasn't flying. I was on ships in those days. When they would go on deployment, the A4 squadrons particularly, if they took 10 airplanes, they would lose 7 or 8 airplanes on deployment. So the safety aspects of what happens today versus back in those days is way different. It's rare to lose an airplane to a landing mishap.
Aviation's definitely a lot safer than it used to be, and I have a lot of respect for you pilots who had to learn in the time that you learned without the advanced avionics and all the fun gadgets. You were just basically just flying by the seat of your pants. That's about it.
Yeah.
But you were also a landing signal officer in LSO for a while. So as part of your responsibility to keep some of those pilots safe, did being in that role kind of shape your understanding of leadership in aviation?
You know, it did a couple things for me. First off, I think it made me a better pilot, because now I could see the mistakes that others were making. And then I can think about that when I went flying to make sure that I did do that. You and the person that's in the cockpit that's coming aboard the ship create, you know, a relationship. And even though you've got all those amazing tools in the airplane, there's still really bad weather or tough situations that you got to get yourself through. And that one-on-one relationship between the LSO and the pilot is a key one to help calm you down if you've had a bad night. And there's a lot of guys that have come back that said, thank you for saving me. I never thought I was going to get there. There's increasing levels of responsibility as you go, as you're experience goes up. And for me, that was probably one of the most rewarding things that I did in aviation, was standing on the back of the boat.
Well, you mentioned how compartmentalization is so important for pilots to make sure that we're staying in the present. And that's one thing as an instructor, I've taught my students as well, is to make sure that if whatever you have going on the ground, or however you're feeling emotionally, you need to compartmentalize all that so you can be safe in the aircraft. And that comes down to also your stress in your home life and stuff like that, whatever it may be. You mentioned you were instructing your LSOs, but you were also one of the first instructors in the FAA-18. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about that experience.
You know, that was interesting because the airplane that I flew, the A7, was a single seat, single radio airplane and single engine as well. And then the F4 guys were coming, and they were dual engine, big, fast, fighter jet kind of guys. Now what we had to do was we had to learn the skills of what the Hornet brought to the fleet, because now it doesn't have enough gas to do this mission from the A7 guys. And then the F4 guys go, well, it may have 2 engines, but it can't go supersonic like we can. So now we essentially had to take all of these guys from different communities and pour them into the F-18 community and help teach them about the things that the airplane brought to the fight that was different. When I was the F-18 program manager, my public affairs officer never wanted me saying this, but I did it all the time. I consider the F-18 to be like a decathlete. Somebody can run the 100-yard dash. Somebody can run the 400 meters. Somebody can broad jump. But when you go to be a decathlete, you got to do all of those. And that means you're not number one, maybe in any of those. But when it comes down to it, it's about how many points you got in each one of those categories. So you're not number one, but you're number two or three in everything. For me, seeing the capabilities of the airplane to be a strike airplane, fighter airplane, tanker airplane, a surveillance airplane, all of those things made it such that I just relished the opportunity to fly that airplane, because you could do anything you needed to on any mission all in one thing. I'll give you examples. So they asked me to go to Korea because the Koreans were talking about buying the Hornets. I said, well, I'm not the guy that you ought to be sending. You ought to send Carl, because Carl's flown the F-16, which is the Air Force's fighter bomber. I went over and talked to Carl and said, hey, give me your favorite airplane based on what your experience has been with the Hornet and with the Falcon. He said, F-16 is a great bombing platform, very stable, great power addition, and then this bomber. But I'll tell you what, to do everything that needs to be done, I'll pick the Hornet every day. That was really a remarkable comment. And then if you go to Desert Storm, one of my fellow air wing was Mark Fox. And Mark Fox and his wingman during Desert Storm were on their way to a mission inside of Iraq. And two MiG-21s came out after them. And they were already set up to drop their bombs. But all they did was toggle over to what they needed to do to shoot the airplanes down. They picked them up on radar. Two MiGs were coming. Wingman shot one down. Merck, MRT. Was his call sign, shot the other guy down, and then they went right back to selecting, you know, what they needed to do to get their weapons off and roll in on the target and drop their bomb. Now, when we designed the Super Hornet, we took those attributes that we learned from the Hornet and just improved those things along the way. It's just a little bit different airplane than the Hornet was. Yeah. Another interesting story was Restart Air Pack calls me one day and said, Jim, I need to talk to you. The Super Hornet doesn't have a name, and we're not going to be able to use Super Hornet on the ball. Every airplane's got its name so that we know when we call the ball, the LSO knows what kind of airplane it is. Is it Prowler? Is it an Intruder? Is it a Hornet? Is it a Corsair? Whatever. It had a one-name thing. When the Super Hornet shows up, well, that ain't going to work on the ball. And so, he said, Jim, we got a problem. The young pilots want to call it the Rhino. And I said, okay, I've heard that. What's the problem? He says, well, I don't think that's the appropriate name for the airplane. And said, hey, boss, I'm going to tell you that if you go messing around with the JOs naming an airplane something that you think it ought to be versus what they think it ought to be, you're going to lose that battle. It is the Rhino today because of that. And they said, well, give me the logic behind Rhino. And says, are you kidding me? Think about it in Africa. A Rhino out there running around, nobody is going to mess with a rhinoceros. That's what they felt with the Super Hornet was Rhino's the perfect name because nobody's going to mess with that airplane.
You said you started in the A-7 and then you transitioned to the FA-18, which was a major leap. So what was the biggest changes you felt in the cockpit from the A-7 Corsair to the FA-18 Super Hornet?
You had displays that were totally different. You had a bombing system that was much improved over what we had in the A-7. The A-7 was a good bomber. But now, for us coming from the A-7, the airplane was characterized, the name of it was called the Sloth. Short, little, empty frets. You can just imagine what the last word is. So with that, we were always on the defensive. We didn't practice offensive maneuvers in the A-7 against a fighter or a bad guy. We always practiced defensive maneuvering because there was never any way that we're going to be, you know, in a situation where we're going to shoot somebody down. Even though we carried the missiles and had the capability, the probabilities are that we're just not going to be in that situation. So now to be able to have a radar that works air to air, that works on air to ground as well, how do you work the nuances between the two? Speed, the addition of power that you have with two engines, the fact that if you lost an engine in an A-7, you're going to jump out of the airplane. I knew a lot of guys not so jumped out of an A-7 on takeoff out of Lemoore because the engine quit.
Well, since you flew the A-7 before you were leading the development and the delivery of the FA-18, do you feel like that helped you in that whole challenge of developing that aircraft, having the experience of the A-7, what you wanted to be better?
Yeah, absolutely. When we first got the airplane, there was no fuel management system in it, and so it was all by gravity. If you're out fighting in practice, you're an afterburner. You're burning gas so fast out of the tanks that are closest to the engine where the fuel pumps are that now the fuel couldn't move fast enough gravity-wise to go from that big tank down into the sump tanks to be able to get the fuel to the engine. So now, I had a problem. And the other was, the airplane in the early days didn't help you with your center of gravity either. And so now if you didn't have a center of gravity right, then the airplane didn't maneuver the same way as it did before. So now you would fly with one engine, an afterburner, one engine and idle to get the fuel to move around to be able to get it to where you need to be. So we fixed that one right away. So that is never going to work in combat. So in the A7, you have no night attack capability other than dropping bombs on a lit target. So now in China Lake, we started introducing night vision goggles and displays that were night vision compatible as well. And so we made a big shift, in the airplanes that we built to go from the F-18 A and B to the F-18 Cs and Ds. They were night attack compatible now. Now we've introduced a whole new bombing method, a whole new method of flying, because now you're going to go race around with goggles on at 200 feet at night. And you couldn't do that on the other airplanes, right? And I'll tell you, I did that. I went to China Lake and I got really comfortable real fast. And that's one of the problems that you got with that is you get so comfortable that 200 feet just feels comfortable.
And that can be dangerous.
Right. You can lose situational awareness and, your reaction time at night is going to be a little bit different and get yourself in real trouble before you knew it. So those are big changes that we made in the airplanes in the day. And if you go back from a pilot workload perspective, the hardest mission that we were going to fly in the A7 was a nuclear mission. And you did that with terrain following radar. Usually at night, you had a clamshell that you put down and you flew your instruments and you flew on the radar through the mountains to the target. And then you would drop your nuclear weapon and go home. So the workload on the pilot for a single pilot in an airplane was you needed really 1.8 people in the airplane to do all the job that needed to be done. Now, when we go to the Hornet, we lowered that down to like 1.3, 1.4. So that was a great move. There's a lot of things that we did to both mechanically and electronically make the airplane work better for the pilot. The weapon systems integration that we did really changed the way that we fought the airplane totally, because now you have tools. It wasn't called AI at the time, but it's probably AI, if you will, because now the airplane recognized things of another airplane, a target with a forward-looking infrared or whatever, and get target recognition that you never had before. It really simplified what you did and gave you more confidence and what you're shooting at or dropping bombs on, when the time came. A lot of evolution in that. Even today, I got to be an advisor on the F-35 when it was being designed and built as well. So now there's things in the Hornet that flowed forward into the F-35 as well, and even went beyond that to help that airplane be even more than what the F-18s were and the Super Hornets were. So I got to not just be a pilot, but I also got to be a design engineer and program manager. And so I didn't just get to deliver the Super Hornet to the fleet in 1999. I got to work on the EA-18G and introduce the replacement for the EA-6B Prowler, and it became the Growler when it became an EA-18G. And also the E-2D was another one. Everything that's on the flight deck today except the helicopter, I had a hand in being on the design side of those airplanes. And so that, to me, when you see those airplanes in combat today, it really heartens me to know that that legacy of what's on the carriers, I got ownership in.
I can only imagine how that feels. I mean, just to be a part of all those amazing aircraft and just everything that you've done, I'm just in awe of everything that you've accomplished throughout your life. It's amazing. You should be very proud of yourself. Absolutely.
Thank you for that.
I bet you've really, really enjoyed seeing how each of these aircraft just continue to advance as time goes on and we keep learning and thriving in the industry. Besides the advancements in avionics and the aircraft themselves, what's a major change in aviation that you've noticed since you've been in the industry?
So our situational awareness has changed a lot. There's a system called ADS-B to keep track of all the people that are around you, both in the air and on the ground. Now you don't need a radar anymore. You don't need a call from the controllers. ADS-B is one of those things that is amazing to see work in real time, because now it'll put your eyes right where it needs to be to see that oncoming or the overtaking airplane. When I flew Cessna 150s, I had an airspeed indicator, an altimeter, turn and bank indicator, and then a radio, and that's about it, right? Navigation, maybe. All of that is integrated now in a display to give you, the aviator, all the information that can be done. The chairman of the board of Mercy Medical is one of our pilots as well. He flies a Cessna 310R, and he's got a lot of the displays and a lot of the other things in there that really help in the landing, coming into the airport to fly the instrument approach, to hook up the autopilot, to do all of those kind of things so that it flies hands off, if you will, to just before touchdown. He had a funny one not too long ago where he went flying on the Vision Jet, which is fully automated. Essentially, you just reach over and flip a switch. The engines turn on, everything comes up online, and you plug in all the information that you need for where you are, where you're going, what altitude of your flight plan, if you will, and then you take off. But after that, you plug in the autopilot, and the airplane does the rest of the way. You lose your basic aviate, navigate, communicate skills if you don't hand fly the airplane. And so David came back and said, I really like the Vision Jet because of all the automation, but I really like to hand fly the airplane. And so I'm going to stick with my 310R.
I actually instructed in Cirrus aircraft, so I am biased towards them. I think they're very cool aircraft, absolutely. But that's one big thing is how you were talking earlier about being too comfortable flying Mach 200 feet above the ground. You don't want to ever be too comfortable in any aircraft you're flying, no matter right. how easy it makes flying for you. You always want to go back to your AV, navigate, communicate. Even though you have ADS-B, you want to make sure you're still looking outside the window if it's a VFR day, because not everybody has to have ADS-B if you're outside the Bravo, right? Right. So it's just little things like that you try and make sure everyone is still thinking about. But these advances in aviation have been phenomenal, and I'm very thankful for them that I get to be a pilot in this time.
You know, I worked for a company after I got out of the Navy that was really going back to the Hornet as a tool for them to figure out how to do things better. If you looked at unmanned vehicles at the time, Pioneer was one of the early vehicles that the Army flew. And if it had a flight control problem, it just flew into the ground. That was it, right? There's a lot of mishaps that occurred because they had a single non-redundant system, a single channel flight control system. And so the company was going to do everything they could to make a quad redundant like the Super Hornet and the Hornet did, so it can lose a channel and still fly away. We were on the early stage of that, but his vision was, you know, I want to get it to the place that if the pilot is on a single piloted aircraft and he dies and he's got passengers, all the passenger has to do is push a button and say, take me to the nearest airport. Or the pilot knows that he's going to have a heart attack or something. He pushes a button and the airplane automatically turns, communicates, and lands at the airport and the passengers get out. But in truth, his real goal was to say, why do you need anybody in the airplane? Why can't we just make an autonomous airplane? And it flies you to Newark, New Jersey, and you can fly to Boston or whatever it happens to be and never see a person. With that in mind, that was his vision for where they were going with that. They didn't achieve that, but they did get the redundancy in the UAVs so that now most UAVs have got a multi-redundant system to give them the ability to get home. His experiment with that was they made an F-18 model, scale model, and they flew it around with a quad-redundant system. The intent was they were going to put a shaped charge on the wing and blow the wing off at the wing fold of the airplane and see what the airplane would do to come home. And it was uneventful. The airplane kind of went, whoa, what was that? And readjusted all the flight controls and then came home and landed. So it really makes a huge difference when you got the backups, you know, to really help you get through rough situations when things start to go to hell in a handbasket.
It's really nice to have all the backups that we have today, especially just the autopilot in general. Just flying now in a plane that has autopilot, going to a plane that doesn't have autopilot, like an old Cessna 172 or something, you're just exhausted after flying a cross-country flight or something. So definitely thankful for all the advancements that we've had. But when it comes to your growth, you were squadron commander and you made it all the way to rear admiral. What's the most important leadership lesson that you still carry with you today?
Do the things that got you to where you were. Consistency. You know, I saw a lot of guys that made it to command and then they thought they became king and they ruled that way. I had a CO that did that as well. A guy that was senior to me a couple of years, retired as a 4-star and one of my instructor pilots. And he is the same today as he was when I met him as a lieutenant. That's one of the things that I wanted to be like, was to be that kind of person that people can look up to. And to get those calls, you know, decades later, look, you may not remember me, but, and then they'll tell me a story about something that I did that made a mark on them that has given them some inflection point in their career that really goes, Okay, so what you did mattered. That's one of the things that I've tried to do through my whole career is be consistent and know what people can expect of me to this day. I mean, I just got the comment a couple of days ago. We know exactly how you're going to write this because you cut to the quick immediately. You don't put any excess verbiage in there. My wife, my kids, they all know that as well. It's really funny to hear things played back to you. And my son is dating a young woman right now, the travel nurse. My youngest daughter said, don't you get too far away from your mother, because if you don't talk to her and you let this girl pull you towards her family too much, you're going to get the daddy call. And so I got a big kick out of that, because now all the girls know, and Hunter, our son, knows as well, that if they fall out of line or there's something that's going on, they're going to get the daddy call. They do not want to receive that daddy call.
So that's the last resort. If daddy calls and you're doing something wrong. Well, I really do like your leadership mentality. I think it's a very, very good way to go about it. Was there ever a decision that you made as a leader that really stuck with you, whether it was a proud moment or maybe a hard lesson?
Yeah. So we had a situation where we had to get rid of a government employee. Dealing with those kind of things hardens you a little bit as well. I'm a problem solver now. I was a problem solver before, but I didn't realize that that's what my skill set was. So now when everybody throws their hands up and goes, oh, well, we can't solve this, I said, let me see it. I do that with automobile repairs, with working around here. I'm 49 acres here in Texas. I'm never going to be without a job around here, because there's always going to be something to do. Something's always breaking. That to me is a lot of fun. A lot of other people don't like that. My wife hates it. So she'll just tell me what it is and I'll go solve the problem. I think back, you know, I was a civil engineer by education, but I never used my civil engineering, if you will, as a straight civil engineer. But the math, the science, the physics, the logic, the thermodynamics, all the stuff that goes into being an engineer helped me in my decision-making process to be able to weigh positives and negatives about why we needed to do something, or where we could take a risk or where we couldn't take a risk. That to me is probably one of the greatest things that college gave me, and playing football in college too. I believe that gave me the leadership and the teamwork. I learned the teamwork thing before I got in the Navy, because in my younger days, not many kids played football. Nobody played soccer in America. You played baseball. And so I learned a lot about teamwork playing football in college well before I got into the Navy.
Oh, yes. Team sports are very helpful in that respect. And now that I know that you enjoy and are good at solving hard problems, I'm just going to save your number on my speed dial. And I'll just give you a call when I need some help.
Yeah. I get that all the time. My sons-in-law are not real mechanical. They have not been. They're learning. But anytime they've got a problem that they can't fix, you know, they call me.
It's good to have someone like you around.
Right. So it's one of those that, you know, the two, they'll commiserate with one another. Can we fix this before Jim shows up? If we don't fix this, you know, he's going to fix this in like 5 minutes and we're going to look stupid. It's hilarious to be involved with that. And, you know, it's just crazy the number of times that it just happened. We were in San Diego for my granddaughter's graduation from USC. And so we had a problem there at the house, and I figured out what it was. And it's on a vehicle. It's not a Jeep.
You sound just as handy as my husband. He can hear a car going down the road and be like, ooh, this is wrong with that. And he can tell you where you can get the part, how long it'll take him to fix it, how much the part cost, and how much it would actually cost if you did it somewhere else. Like it's pretty cool having that around.
Right.
So thinking back on your entire life and all the amazing experiences that you've had, or the not so amazing experiences, what's some advice that you would give a young officer or an aspiring aviator to have a meaningful and long lasting career, besides don't crash your plane?
Yeah. And, you know, listen, there's a lot of things you can do. They call it hangar talk. The ability to hear stories of the things that have happened to people along the way, regardless of when it was, really helps you to shape what you're doing in your aviation career. So listening is really a great thing. I learned a lot from people that flew in Vietnam, that had combat missions, that did things that stuck with me forever. It is those things that I worry about with this generation right now, the Gen Z, that think that they know everything because they've seen it on YouTube. You know, it helps, but the experience of what has happened oftentimes is more valuable than what you learn on that, because you got to sometimes you got to watch YouTube two or three times to get it, right? And even I, as a problem solver, will go in there and look at, oh, no, that's not the way you want to do that. I think one of the greatest things happened, I went to trade school at 73 years old to learn how to weld. And so sometimes the practical skills is what you need. You don't need the bookworm, and you need the math, but you don't need it in a lot of situations. And so I go back, I told people this just a few weeks ago, flying the A7 gave me a lot of appreciation for things that I needed to think about all the time. And so now when you're single engine, single radio, and single pilot, and you're flying all by yourself out in the middle of nowhere, I was always looking for someplace to land. And so I needed to know if I couldn't get there, I needed to find some place where I could put the airplane in a position. I could either crash land it or I could jump out of it and survive. Those things have stuck with me the whole time that I've lived this life. I'm always looking for some alternative to what's going on. I think the discipline, the regimen, the life lessons that you get from other people along the way prepare you in a whole different way. And that's why when employers out there see somebody coming out of the service, they're going to see what skill sets they've got and they're going to hire them before they're going to hire somebody else. You know, when we look at resumes, you look at a resume of three guys, let's say, and one of them's an Eagle Scout and they're all equal. Guess who you're going to pick, you know, to be the guy that you're going to take? And take the Eagle Scout because he learned the hard way. He learned things that he didn't get from other places. The same sort of thing applies to a military career. I never thought when I started in 1973, never in a million years would I have ever thought that I would have done 33 years in the Navy. Never would I have thought that I would have made it 2-star admiral. I just watched and learned from other people that served as well, that got out and then would come back and say, don't get out. You missed the camaraderie and the relationships, and the why is just totally different than driving a bus around the skies. And so stay where you are. That stuck with me along the way. I have relationships with guys today. Like my best friend is my hunting partner. He and I see each other one time a year during elk season. Sometimes we'll hunt and sometimes we'll just sit in the car and talk hours about how things have been, where we're going, what's the advancements in the airplanes. He got out as a commander and flew for UPS. He is not able to fly anymore. He's a stage 4 cancer survivor. So I go see him because that is the guy. If something were to happen to me or him, we're going to go take care of the family. There's just a common bond that exists and the love that we have for one another because we've been through the devil together. And so it's great to have those things that mark your life along the way with people, the milestones that you achieve and promotions, the things that you accomplish and how you go up the ladder. I don't think I could have ever done anything else. I'd go back and do it again.
Well, that's good to know that you're where you're at and you just thoroughly enjoyed everything. And that's kind of how I feel about aviation as well. I think it's so diverse. There's so many different things that you could be doing. It's not just a one track kind of industry. You meet amazing people along the way, make great friends. So it's definitely a very fun and ever changing industry to be a part of. So thank you for all of that information from your past the military and everything that you've learned. Let's shift gears now a bit and talk about Mercy Medical Angels. What was the spark or the aha moment, if you will, that inspired you to take on this miraculous mission?
So it goes back 23 years. I was active duty still. I was usher in church, and it was Veterans Day, and I had my uniform on. And one of the guys in the audience came up to me and said, Admiral, would you consider coming to a meeting with me on Monday night? I said, sure, bud. What is it? I said, well, I'm not going to tell you. I just trust me. Just show up. I went to the meeting. It was a board meeting for Mercy Medical Angels. I heard the stories. I heard the founder and CEO talk about the mission and all that was going on. I saw the things that they were doing and I went, oh my gosh. And my wife goes to bed early. She and I have been married 50 years. And so she knows me and I know her pretty well as well, right? I got home, it was 10 o'clock and I climbed in bed and wake her up and said, now I'll tell you what, I could join this and have the job that CEO has got and the passion that he's got for what goes on. I don't need the money. That's what I would do. A few days later, I get a phone call and said, Dabra, would you go to dinner with the chairman and I? And I said, sure. I walk in, they're sitting there. And I said, if you guys are trying to talk me into joining the board for Mercy Medical Angels, I've already made that decision. I'm more than willing to join. Why don't we enjoy dinner and talk about other things? That was the beginning of my relationship with Mercy Medical Angels. So now I matriculated through the organization. I became the vice chairman. I became the chairman of the board when our chairman retired. There have been some really hard spots that we had in the organization that needed to be fixed, and we fixed those, and I was in charge of fixing those things. When I got to be the chairman, we had just hired a new CEO. He was not only our CEO, he's one of our pilots, and he was one of our patients as well. He had lung cancer before. His girlfriend calls and says, he's in the hospital. And I said, okay, well, we'll find a temporary replacement admiral. He's not going to come back. The next day, he was dead. So now, as the chairman of the board, I wrote to our board members and said, I would like to step down from my role as the chairman of the board, and I'd like to compete for the job, or I'd like to take the job as president and CEO. This could make a real difference in people's lives. There was just so much passion throughout the whole organization that this was just the right place to be. I competed against 61 people, and I got selected for the job. I've been in the job now for a little over 4 years, and we've been growing at 20%+ a year, which is unheard of in small business. It's usually a much smaller number. When I submitted our strategic plan 4 years ago, and I told them we're going to grow at 15%, no joke. That can't happen. 12% max. I'm not going to accept anything more than that. And I said, okay, David, we submitted our plan. We executed the first year, and we didn't achieve 12%. We achieved 18%. And so I went to David, and he goes, I get it. They're blowing their life. You guys do what you want. And so 23.8% the next year, 28.5% the following year, 18% last year. Conversation with one of our employees. She's our director of operations. I just told her, you know, if you guys don't like the growth that we're seeing, then you need to fire me. Yes. The path that we're going to be on is the path, as long as I'm here, we're going to be on. It's been really rewarding in the relationship that gets built. Me being able to teach people that are dealing in the aviation business that don't know anything about aviation, to be able to teach them the phonetic alphabet. So when they're talking to our aviators, they can talk aviator. And some of the things that we've changed since I've been there is we have ready room Zooms every quarter. We'll put a full call out there to our pilots, and then we'll talk aviator. We go on recruiting trips, and we'll recruit younger aviators to come fly with us. We've done really well. Since January, we recruited, I don't know, 15 or 20 new pilots. That's very rewarding to see younger people, not like us old guys that are having trouble with insurance and getting qualified to medical to go do what needs to be done. This organization's got a long way to go. We're the only nationwide provider of transportation that exists out there today. Others are regional and have their private pilots and their commercial aviation connection, but we provide those, and we do gas cars, we do Uber, we do trains, we do everything, every form of transportation you can imagine that we can do to be able to get somebody from their home to a medical appointment. 60% of medical appointments go unmet because they can't get there. Federal poverty guidelines is what we use as our qualification standard. We give them the opportunity to come fly with us and go to places that will take care of them for no charge for whatever happens to be. And we get them there, no charge for flying them to get there. It's just rewarding to see stories. And to be on a mission, you know, I got to fly a mission with our chairman. She had thyroid cancer, and she was 9 years old, diagnosed with that. We flew her to MD Anderson. The doctors told the mom, because mom always flew with her daughter, we don't expect her to make it through the year. And I went on the mission that flew her 5 years later to go back for her quarterly checkups. And so when you see those stories of those things that happen like that. It's adults, children, it's dogs getting tagged to their service person. It's just absolutely rewarding to see. And the people that get the transportation to the care are so grateful for what happens to them because they just not been able to do it. If you get a cancer diagnosis, that's a path to bankruptcy. If you have got a lot of money, you're not going to have it for very long because cancer is just going to take you to your knees. What we ultimately want to do is we don't want to have any federal poverty guidelines. If somebody needs to get to medical transportation, we want to provide it.
It sounds like you've done a really good job with all the work you've done since you've been in your position. That's really great to hear that. The first time I've heard about Mercy Medical Angels was I was doing an episode on ways to build flight hours to tell students, not students, but people who need to just build flight hours to get to their ATP minimums or whatever it may be. And I said, volunteering is a good way to do that as well. And so I mentioned Mercy Medical Angels. But could you walk us through a typical angel flight, what it looks like, and certain challenges that you'd go to from the phone call to the touchdown?
So we don't use phone calls much anymore. That's dating you and I both. But we have a portal, number one, and we are on the website. MercyMedical.org is our website, and anybody can go on there and request transportation. It has you fill out an electronic form. Then we'll call you to get a doctor's verification of your financial status, and a few other things like that. We have 6 coordinators that work across the board. We have our Angel Flight coordinators, commercial coordinators, gas card coordinators, Uber coordinators. We're a virtual organization now. We virtualized before COVID hit. That's how we get everybody scheduled and how we send them their schedule for their flight, how we communicate to the pilots what happens. After we log that person in, we approve the flight. Then we post an email to all our pilots 3 times a week that says available missions, and now they can go and bid on those missions. If we're flying an SR-22 or a Cessna 150, we usually say that the legs are about 300 miles for an airplane like that. Then either they can gas up and go the next leg, or they can hand off to somebody else. Now you can take as many of those legs as you think you can take. Our chairman of the board, Nat 310R, go 1,000 miles of 1,000 pounds. He'll go to Kentucky or Tennessee and pick somebody up and fly them directly to Houston. One of our board members is a vision jet pilot. He'll fly somebody from Northern Virginia to Atlanta. We're recruiting all the time to bring pilots on board. Once they've got control of the patient in their airplane, they're doing the same things you or I would do as an aviator. Is that airport close enough to your house? Could we go to such and such an airport so the drive would be as long for you? When we land in Houston or Cleveland or Boston, could we get you closer to where you need to be so that you've got the transportation to get to the hospital or your hotel or to your lodging, whatever it happens to be. And we do everything we can do to accommodate what bad situation the patient is in. The compassion piece of what we do is probably what draws everybody to us, because if you don't have compassion, you're not going to do this job. Our chairman, again, started flying with us several years ago, 6 years ago, and he said, I'll fly any missions you want, but don't give me any stage 4 cancer patients. I don't think I can handle that. Personally, not that he couldn't, he could, but he didn't think that processing that and what he had to deal with that person and their life state would be difficult. And then he flew a stage 4 cancer patient. And then he calls back to the coordinators and says, I don't want to fly anything but stage 4 cancer patients from now on. That's what it means. That's the emotion. And that's the passion that people have got to do this mission. It never ceases to amaze me, the challenges, the things that we see, the things that we have to do. I've told our coordinators, I could never do the job that you do in dealing with the patients, dealing with their personal lives and the situations, because there's so many stories that they tell you of what's going on. I couldn't do that. My wife has said she couldn't do that either. When we were doing it on the phone years ago, she sat in there for a while. We were having a board meeting. Listen, those ladies are amazing. I could never do that. I couldn't go home at the end of the day, you know, without crying or whatever happened to me. It's really tough, especially when you see little kids that have got cancer. Really just rips your heart out when you see what happens. Or if you're flying somebody that's got stage 4 cancer and they pass away, you just lost a piece of your life, because now you're invested in that person. The dedication that our pilots, we got 680 pilots.
Wow.
Of that, a little over 400 are registered all the time, and probably 60 to 80 of our pilots really do a lot of flying. Other guys will fly one mission. We don't have a lot of women aviators, so we'd love to have more women, and we'd love to have more jets and turboprop airplanes as well. That means a lot to us from a financial perspective. When they donate their time, their gas, their airplane, and their maintenance, that's on them. I'm not paying them to do that. That's their donation. They get a tax break for doing that. And we get recognition for what's called public benefit flying and in-kind remuneration. You know, we're about $6 million total organization with what we do, because the in-kind piece of what our normal is $3-something million a year.
I cannot believe all the how far you guys have come, and how incredible this just sounds overall. It must be very difficult work to do. A rewarding work, like you mentioned. So if there are any pilots that are listening or watching this, how would you tell them to go about becoming a volunteer, or people who want to volunteer their aircraft but are not pilots? How would you tell them what to do?
We have a program, and the FAA approved this. We have a fuel reimbursement program. And so there's a lot of times that people will have a church or have an individual that give a grant or give them a donation that allows us to, as long as you know, the pilot has a commercial ticket and has got 500 total hours and 50 hours in type instrument rating, the medical insurance will give them the ability to fly with us. On our webpage, you want to fly with us, there's a button and you just apply to start registering to fly with us. We just did one the other day. We had a fly-in to the airport down near Norfolk, and one of the guys flew with his wife in to meet with us because he'd heard about us, and he's getting ready to buy a Vision jet, and he flies an SR-22 now, and a Cardinal RV is what he showed up in when he flew in. The organization that he flies are realtors, and they own airplanes because they go back and forth from Northern Virginia to Florida. And so now they're saying, if you can find something to do with our airplanes, we'd like to keep them flying. We'd love to see them put to good use. And so he's going to come fly for us and use their airplanes. We also share with our memorandum of agreement partners like Wounded Warrior Foundation. We've got relationships with these folks. We share the flight or whatever it happens to be with them so that they don't foot the whole bill for what they're doing and give them more money to put towards treatment. We're always looking for organizations that have got airplanes of any kind that would be willing to let their airplanes be used by one of their pilots to fly somebody to a medical mission. We'd love to have jets more than anything else because when we fly 300-mile legs and we do three of them back-to-back, that can take all day and that can take a lot of energy out of you. Takeoff and landing and altitude, you know, and all that sort of stuff. For people especially that are stressed, they're not flying a lot of little airplanes. Well, we're never going to turn a pilot down that wants to fly. We would love when we get the longer leg flights to put them on a single airplane and fly a direct leg to get there and not have to worry about stopping. But they're flying at their expense with no reimbursement. If they deadhead a leg, that's on their nickel. I mean, everything's on their nickel, but they're not getting credit for all the deadhead legs. They only get credit when they've got a patient on board. That's why a lot of guys won't take missions that take them out of their region very far because now they don't want to have too much of a deadhead.
So to volunteer as a pilot, do you have to have an aircraft with you or can you just hop in some aircraft that you guys already have on the volunteer status?
We don't own any airplanes anymore. We did at one time. We don't anymore. But other organizations do own airplanes, but not many of them anymore. Some people lease airplanes. And so we talked to one of the guys that is getting certified in the Cirrus and plans to rent the airplane to go do these missions. There's another guy that's in Richmond that's got airplanes that are not being used all the time. He's a charter service. And he said, if we can get the gas paid for, I'm willing to lease my airplanes or I'm willing to have my son fly the missions, you know, to do what needs to be done. We're trying to get that established. So really any pilot we're accepting, but we have only got like a couple German airplanes and one jet. So we need more of that just from the standpoint of longer haul, more weight capacity. A Cirrus is pretty limited. If you put a pilot, patient, and luggage in the airplane, it's older. With that in mind, a lot of the times, you know, it's the pilot, the patient, and the escort. Oftentimes, a lot of these patients have got a lot of things, medications or equipment that they've got to take with them, oxygen or other things like that when they get to their destination. And so it makes it really challenging. And a lot of pilots can't take some of the missions because of the weight limit. And the way that we handle this is if we put it out there and the pilot can't take it and we can see that it's not going to work, then we'll do a reconnection and we'll give them a conversion flight and we'll put them on a commercial airliner to get them to their destination. So the patient's not going to miss the appointment. We're going to just change the method of transportation to get them there.
I like that. I like that, y'all. Even if you can get your own pilot airplane to get there, then you're going to get them there regardless. So that's nice that they can actually rely on you guys for that and that it's not going to fall through because of one reason or another.
Right.
So if any of you guys listening out there, if my viewers or anyone who's watching out there, if you have some extra time or money to donate to Mercy Medical Angels, they would greatly appreciate it, particularly if you fly a jet or turboprop aircraft. What do you hope that the next generation of pilots, military or civilian, takes away from your journey that we've learned about today?
So one of our pilots was John Billings. He is a World War II bomber pilot in the Army Air Corps. He flew with us until he was 96 years old. He had a co-pilot that flew with him. He had medical waivers, but John was so passionate about flying that he would just not stop. He died a couple of years ago, and it was one of those that, you know, you look at what that man saw in his life before the CIA was the CIA, dropping paratroopers behind German lines to be able to get intelligence and to do the things that need to be done. I really think that flying these people and the way that and the care that they do, a lot of people view and our chairman views the stuff that he does as a ministry. He really is deeply invested in what the patients is going through in their life and what he can do. Pilots will always ask, if you would like for me to turn the radios off so you don't have to listen to all that, or you don't want me to talk to you, I can shut up the comms. Oh, no, we'd love to have the conversation. And then the life of that event comes out, right? That's when you learn about three children, two of which had got the same thing and all that sort of stuff. And so that meaning, that's never going to go away. There's always going to be people that are going to need to get to the doctor for one reason or another. We want to be there to help them do that. And we just received the Public Benefit Flying Award for last year, just a few months ago. That is like a milestone achievement for this organization. We've been in existence for 53 years.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Right now, are you a CFI?
Yes, sir.
So you ought to think about flying with us too.
I'd love to. I just don't have an aircraft to bring with me.
What do you got quills in then?
I have my SIC rating in a Citation 500 series, and I'm checked out in the TBM 930 and Epic 1000.
You know, one of our board members was a former executive with Norfolk Southern. She married her boyfriend later in life. They were flying missions in his airplanes. She said, hey, look, what airplane do you need to be able to do these missions faster, carry more, and do whatever? She went and bought him a TBM. After they got that airplane, I guess they had it for a while. They were talking again as they were flying a mission. And she says, is there anything you would do to upgrade this airplane? He goes, yeah, we would buy the latest TBM 950, whatever it is.
I think it's 960 now.
Yeah, yeah. So she bought him one of those.
Okay.
Yeah. So if I was going to, you know, if I was going to own an airplane that was going to get me where I needed to go. Now, if I was really going to do it, I want a Gulfstream G650, you know, something like that. Because now I've always told the kids, if I own an airplane like that, I don't care where you live. If we decide we're going to go to Australia, I'll fly to wherever you are. I'll pick you up and take the whole family to Australia. You know,
that'd be a dream.
Yeah, because we can one-leg it to Australia.
Right. Oh, someday. Yeah. But no, I fly the TBM 930 for my full-time job, but it's a very busy aircraft, and the Epic is also busy. It's another single-engine turboprop.
Yeah.
But those are a lot of fun. Well, Jib, thank you. Your story is a reminder that flying is so much more than just altitude and airspeed. It's about purpose and service and heart. So thank you for your time and your wisdom, and of course, your incredible service to both country and community. And again, to all of our listeners out there, if you are a pilot with some extra hours to give, or just someone who wants to help, then please go check out Mercy Medical Angels online and consider getting involved. Thanks for joining us on the Aviator's Guide. Until next time, stay safe and keep flying with heart. And we will see you later, Aviators.
See you later, Aviators.